the Torah admits the Shemashi. Right? That he still kept the Torah. And we explained that why it's very important in the whole psychology of anti-Semitism that we went through the whole psychology, that was the essence of last week's shiur. The psychology of anti-Semitism, even though it's rooted in the factor of envy that the Jews were given the Torah, but still in all, when the Jews deviate from Torah and compete with the Gentile, and they go into the Gentile's area, and they become corrupt to a certain extent in keeping the mitzvot, then it becomes easier for the Gentile to rationalize his hatred of the Jew, and anti-Semitism comes out even more. So in other words, the popular notion that people have, that Jews always had throughout the centuries, that if we assimilate and we become more like the Gentile, then that will remove the hatred, it turns out to be the opposite of the truth. But the Gentile is less apt to hurt the Jew. He has more respect. He's more restrained when he has the respect to the fact that the Jew is keeping the Torah. Alright, now, we're going to take it up from that point. We're in chapter 32, if you have a Chumash. Pasuk Zion. So now the messengers return to Yaakov, and they say, "We've come to your brother Esau, and he's coming out to meet you with 400 men. He's coming out to meet you with 400 men." So, what was the reaction of Yaakov? So Yaakov was extremely frightened. Vayira Yaakov Miod, he was extremely frightened by Yetalo, and he was. Messengers in Esau to bring out this fear. The Torah doesn't describe the meeting between the messengers. We have to deduce for ourselves. Did Esau receive these messengers? Was he impressed with what they had to say? And what did he tell them? All they report to Yaakov is that we've come to your brother Esau. Banu al achicha Esau, we've come to him. And Ramban learns that he never received them. In other words, that they went to his camp, Yudan Ramban, that they went to his camp, it was 400 people, 400 men, I mean, there might have been other people as well, you know, workers and so on and so forth, that's a pretty huge group, and you had to, I assume you had to have permission to, Esav was the leader, he was their leader. So it would seem from the Ramban that Esav heard that they were there to see him, but he didn't want to meet with them, he didn't even give them a chance. So they took it from the way he treated them that they weren't even interested, that Esau was not even interested in any kind of reconciliation, and instead he's coming out to meet you with 400 men, which apparently gave Yaakov the impression that he's in serious danger, because what else? He doesn't even want to talk peace, he's not in any mood of reconciliation. So what was the reaction of Yaakov? It's very interesting to note the reaction. He was extremely frightened by Yira, he had tremendous fear. And what did he do? It says he divided the camp and the animals that were with him into two camps. He set up two separate camps. The rabbis, as I'll say, that he prepared in three ways. In three ways, he prepared for Muhammad, even though he was very weak and very small group, but nevertheless, you have to do whatever is in your power. He prepared for war. Then, and he said, in Yoro Esav, Machna Achas, because if Esav will attack one camp, then the other one will be then the other camp will be for salvation. And you have to realize also, it's interesting that this story is to be understood on two different levels. Aside from plain meaning, there's a symbolical level of interpretation, which is a similar doro. This story is really a preview of Jewish history. Now what's the significance of Ramban explains? What's the significance of this? That if he comes and attacks one camp, then the other camp will be for salvation. So he's preparing, on the practical level, he's preparing to save whatever we could save. If we divide up into two groups, then one group possibly could help the other, or if he attacks one group, the other group will escape. I mean, there's no point, even if you can't save the entire group, you save whatever you could save. You always have to be practical-minded. Which goes against the normal psychology, because a lot of people have the all-or-nothing attitude. We all stick together, we think or swim together. But sometimes you can't operate that way. Sometimes you have to be ready to accept the fact that half of the group will be destroyed. You save whatever you can save. But what's the symbolical lesson in Jewish history? Ramban says this symbolizes something, a recurrent situation in Jewish history. Jackie? Of the Jews in the exile. And God worked it out. I mean, this has been our history. The history of Jewish-Gentile relations has always been constant persecution throughout all of history until this day. And even today, the Jews are still in danger in Israel, the Jews in Russia. But it was always v'hamachana hanisha v'fleita. God worked it out in such a way that the Jews were never gathered together in one place so that they could all ever be destroyed. They were always split up into separate camps, just like in this story. And whenever the Jews were attacked in one place, they always had salvation from another place, because the Jews in a different community were prosperous, and they were able to save them and ransom them and raise money, or they could escape from one community and go to another. And that's been the pattern of Jewish history. So the pattern of Jewish history is really symbolized in this parsha. I'm just mentioning that. We're not really... Our main focus is not the symbolical. It's just interesting to mention in a couple of places where that occurs. Anyway, he prepares for three things. He prepares for war. And what's the next thing? In Yud. By Yom Yaakov, Elokei Avi Avram, then he's tefillah. This is what's called tefillah, prayer. He prays to God. Now he prays. The God of my father Avram, the God of my father Yitzchak, the God who said to me, return to your land and to your birthplace and I'll be good to you. Katonti mikol hachasadim, I'm unworthy of all of the goodness, the compassion, and the truth that you've done for your servant. For with my staff, I crossed over this Yarden. In other words, I left my home with nothing but my staff, and now I've grown into two camps. So please save me from my brother, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. And he mentioned again, for I am afraid of him, lest he come and smite a mother with her children. And you have said, I will be very exceedingly good to you, and I will make your children like the sand of the sea, which can't be counted because of its multitude. That's the second thing. What was the third thing? Doron is called. But Doron, diplomacy, gift. Diplomacy, gift. It's basically the two are intertwined. Very interesting to contrast, when I was reading the parsha, to contrast the reaction of Yaakov, which other group would you contrast his reaction with in a similar type of a situation in the Torah? I mean, I'm not that specific, I'm old today. But there is another, not individual, but group of Jews that you might want to contrast Yaakov's reaction to a similar encounter. Both of them have the experience of fear. I was thinking of the Meraglim. You say to them, no, there's a difference, because we say that the sin of the Meraglim, they were sent out to spy out the land, and they saw great, mighty men. It's pretty similar to what he looks at, and he sees a tremendous army, 400 people arrayed against him. Difference, there's a contrast. The difference? Exactly. In other words, there's no sin. There's no defect in having fear. No. I'm saying contrast. The contrast is that we see from this, we sometimes have a false notion of the tzaddik. The tzaddik is totally fearless. But here we see Yaakov has fear. He's not ashamed of the fact that he has fear. He doesn't deny. There's no need to deny. He has fear. So there's no sin. There's no corruption. And the Meraglim had fear too. But the chet of the Meraglim was that they denied it, and in the end they wound up giving in to the fear. They based their actions, their decisions, their whole estimate was based upon the emotion of fear. Whereas in the case of Yaakov, he experiences the fear, he acknowledges the fear, but then he puts it on one side and says, but now I can't act on the basis of my fear. So the greatness of the tzaddik is his capacity to acknowledge his emotions, and the Meraglim couldn't acknowledge their emotions. They destroyed it. They said there's something wrong with the land. It's a land which buries its, which consumes its inhabitants, and so forth. They couldn't acknowledge their own defects. And because they couldn't acknowledge the fear, in the end, they wound up giving in to the fear. They were consumed by it. But the tzaddik has emotions. And if he's in a dangerous situation, he experiences the fear. But the greatness is, the first thing is not to repress the emotion, not to be ashamed. I'm afraid. He prays to God, I'm afraid. Because once a person does that, he has the opportunity to put that emotion and say, okay, I have the emotion, but I cannot allow my thinking and my decision to be based upon the emotion. That's why I say I contrast that with the way the Maragdim reacts to fear. Yeah. It's an obvious point, but it's something which bears emphasis, is that he did not run away from the reality. And even in terms of preparing for war, as I said, there is a certain attitude of hopelessness that overcomes a person when he sees the odds, overwhelming odds. He was facing a situation. It wasn't anything near an even kind of a fight. It wasn't anything near that situation. He was hopelessly outnumbered physically. But nevertheless, it did not prevent him. No. Nevertheless, nowhere near it. It did not. Where did he get 400 people from? He just had some servants. He had some servants. He had a family, his children, the wives, and some servants. No. He's wealthy. He had wealth, but that doesn't mean he had an army that was prepared to fight. So he was hopelessly outnumbered. But nevertheless, he did not have any attitude of, as I said, of despair. Now, the next thing. What's the next thing? The next thing is the doron, the gift or the diplomacy. He then prepares for diplomacy. So, classically, that's the lesson. That the rabbis, whenever they had to meet the anti-Semites or the Gentiles to deal with them, throughout history, they always opened up this parsha. And the three classical responses are, which one is the most preferable? Three classical responses to a situation of danger is prayer. We prepare with prayer, we prepare with doron, and we prepare with war. The order in which they occur is not necessarily the order of preference. What is the preferred method? Is doron. The preferred method is, we're going to analyze that at length, is doron. It doesn't come about in that order. And however, because we would prefer to resolve the issue without having to go to war. And the reason, the factor which compels us, which motivates us to go to war, is not the enjoyment of war itself, not the desire for conquest, but simply because we have no other choice. And if there is any other choice, it's always preferable to do that. Now, my question is like this, to begin with. I mean, I want to devote most of this year to analyzing the diplomacy. The term doron is gift. All right? Gift. It's interesting what diplomacy really boils down to. If, you read about negotiations and plans and ideas, the bottom line is usually it's right. That's the essence. Same thing. It's the same thing. I want to frame this year with this question. The order of activities. The first thing he did was he prepared for war, divided the camp. Of course, even though we're saying that's the last resort, but that's what he did first. Okay, that might make sense. What would you question in terms of the order? It was, in the way it occurred, it was war, prayer, doron. Now, is there anything that you might see as being ambiguous or, questionable in terms of the order? I have a question on that. My question is, why does prayer come in the middle? That seems to not make sense. The fact that it comes in the middle. I could see it coming, one second. I could see it coming even at the beginning. In other words, as we see in the case of, where do we see prayer coming at the beginning? No, I'm talking about Esther. I was thinking about Esther. By the way, when I say no, I'm not saying that you're wrong. I mean, I'm not thinking that way. In the case of Esther, it seems that prayer came first, because before she even put together, formulated the plan of action, right, what did she say? Kenos kol yehudim v'tzumu. Oh, fasting. The fasting is tefillah. It's tshuva. Tefillah, it's all one unit. And then, only after that, is she willing to go to the king, uncalled for, right, unsummoned, which is risking her life. Because whoever went there could be killed. The subsequent story. She put the plan up. Famous plan into action. So prayer comes first. Or I could see, doing the activities that have to be done, and prayer coming last. After you've prepared everything, first you take care of business. And after you've done everything you can do, then you pray. I could see prayer coming either first or last. But in the middle doesn't seem to make any sense. You see, so then you say, what do you mean in the middle? I mean, either you've decided before you do anything you're going to pray, Or you decide that after you've taken care of your business, you're going to pray. But right in the middle, in between, that's a bit difficult. Okay? That's my question. I hope you don't have the answer. Yeah, Jackie. That in order to answer this question, we have to understand the nature of the dodo, the nature of the diplomacy. What was the concept behind diplomacy? On the surface, the diplomacy seems to be very simplistic. It consists of a bribe, an elaborate bribe. You read the story, he presents him with this tremendous gift, mainly of these animals. But yes, of course, animals in those days were a source of tremendous wealth. And he takes out, he chooses the best, and he divides them up very carefully, and he separates them. That's another one. I'll just focus on this. That's the other symbolic lesson, the revach patino, and place a distance between herd and herd. What's the symbolic lesson for Jewish history in that? Ramban pointed out. You've done Ramban. What does that refer to in Jewish history? There'll always be a revach. Revach is a breathing room. Havacha. Revach also means prophet in contemporary Hebrew. Revach means a space. There'll always be a breather. The Ramban says this means that even though our history will be one of persecutions, but God will set it up, the revach that you know. There'll be a breather between persecution and persecution. See? Then that's... No. It's a positive thing, which means to say that we'll always be able to recuperate. That even though we'll suffer, the chol dor v'dor, but God will always work it out in such a way that we'll never be totally overwhelmed. There'll always be a breather. Of course, it doesn't mean... Of course, if we do tshuva, you know, it doesn't mean that it has to be this way. I mean, if we do tshuva, that's if we're punished. If we do tshuva, and we return to God, so there won't be any persecution. You know, but assuming that we don't, that's the real thing. Anyways, I have some questions on the whole idea of the diplomacy. I have some questions. I want to analyze that. I don't know. It seems rather simplistic that a simple bribe would be sufficient in this situation because of a number of reasons. And you see, first of all, as Jackie pointed out, this brought about an enormous change in Esav. You see, the nature of the reaction seems to be tremendously excessive. And ironically enough, he has this reaction, this change of heart, even before he receives the gift. Yeah. That's the irony of the whole thing. And in fact, he doesn't even want. And he doesn't even want the gift. Yaakov has to force it down his throat. So what was Yaakov's idea then? Was Yaakov's idea that... And how did he evaluate? What was his evaluation of Esav? Was Esav such a simplistic kind of a person? No. I mean, it's true. There are different kinds of anti-Semites, and by and large, you know, most people who hate the Jews are not such idealists, and usually they have very strong, you know, personal motivations and materialistic, and you can buy them off. But when you're dealing with someone who's very highly motivated, for example, like Hitler, Yamach Shemo, could not be bought off. In the Nazi period, by the way, many Jews could have been saved with bribes. There were many, many rescue attempt opportunities that were overlooked for various reasons. Some of them were squelched by the American government, the British government. That's one part of the story. But even there are, unfortunately, certain Jewish groups also aided the attempts to squelch them. That's a whole different story. But we shouldn't think that the hatred was such that there was no opportunity for rescue. And many Jews were saved by simple bribery. Many Nazis could be reached and bribed. But then there were those who were the real idealists. And a person like Hitler, for example, could not have been bribed by any money in the world. In fact, as has been pointed out, the Holocaust was not a cost-effective operation. And it was a significant factor in contributing to the German defeat. They had to divert tremendous amounts of resources from fighting the war. They were fighting the war. On many, many fronts, and they needed all the a lot of the generals in the army complained about the fact diversion of resources. It required a tremendous amount of resources to herd up the Jews and to transport them and to maintain, you know, the concentration camps and so forth. But that was something that he did out of idealism. That was in Hitler's last testament to the German people, his final message when all of Germany was going down. His message was to keep up the war, not against Russia or against communism, against the Jews. That's his final testament. Now, Esau strikes as being more of a you know, a person, he's not a simple person that you could just buy off after 22 years. Exactly, that's my next question. First of all, he was very wealthy himself. And when he says, I have a lot, yeshli rav, right? He doesn't want these guys. He was extremely wealthy. And the idea of simply trying to bribe somebody who has very passionate hatred, and the passionate hatred is rooted in deeper factors, seems to be very, very difficult to understand. And I thought of something else. He could just take the gift if that was. He could just take the gift and kill him anyway. You see, the gift didn't seem to offer any kind of protection. It wasn't as though Yaakov was going to stay behind and send out a messenger offering, you know, if you'll make peace with me, I'll pay you. You know, if you have the money in some Swiss bank account, and you have some protection. But here, Yaakov is going forth. He's putting himself in the line of fire, and the wives and the children are all lined up to meet Esau. Which means to say, at that point he doesn't know whether Esau is going to be pacified or not. So what good is this whole thing? Esau can take the gift and kill him anyway. So for all of these reasons, I think it's essential that we have to obtain a deeper understanding of what was the diplomacy over here. Diplomacy in general. Well, this type of diplomacy. I don't think it's as we understand it on a simple level, that he's just trying to buy him off. I don't think it's that simple. It's after 22 years of hatred, you don't just buy off a person. Yet that, it would seem, on the surface, that that's what Yaakov is trying to do. So I'd like to analyze that. Lori? What he had to do was to effectuate a change in the attitude of Esau, which was based on very powerful emotions. So simply to say, well, okay, I don't want I'm not a materialist, I'm giving the materialism, I'm going back to my realm, to my tent, I don't think that would have been enough at this point. I think he had to do something more than that. Although what you're saying is true, but he has to go beyond that. Jan? As far as our understanding of what the gift was, it wasn't a simple bribe. Esau was a significant, he was a leader. He wasn't a fool. And anybody who has any, you have to realize also that there's a tremendous danger in a bribe. When you bribe another individual, first of all, the person might think you're bribing him. That has to be hidden very carefully too. Anybody who has any measure of self-respect, it's an insult to that person. So that's another. Anyway, he was intelligent, Jason. He was not a stupid individual. You see, he was very cunning. He was very sharp. He was able to fool Yitzchak. He's a very smart person. So there's a danger. I mean, what are you going to try and buy him off? You're saying that he's a low-level person. You see? So there's also another danger in that it's not easy to give a gift to a person who is a man of means. Because nobody wants to be the recipient. It's very hard. A lot of people don't want to receive gifts. Not everybody wants to, you follow, because especially a wealthy person. The wealthy person wants to feel that he's the benefactor. You see, in the end, they have a debate. Esau doesn't want to accept it. Why didn't he want to accept it? Because when you're accepting a gift, you're giving up a certain feeling. In other words, you're admitting, yeah, that's right. There's a certain feeling of superiority. I am now the recipient. There's a, you know, like, well, of course, there's an emotion. People like to receive gifts. That's one emotion. But, you see, for a person that has a lot, and he's a man of stuff, he likes to have the other feeling, but he's the benefactor. Now, that's why they don't like to. A lot of successful people don't like to receive gifts. It's very hard to get a person to receive a gift from you, because then the person is saying that he's a recipient. You're taking away from his feeling that he's the benefactor of people. So there are two emotions over here, and control. So it's not so simple. Now, to analyze it, let's start off with something which Jackie mentioned before, the reaction. The reaction of Esau. Let's take a look at the reaction. This is in Lamed Gimel, Pasuk Dalet. It says that Esau ran out to meet him, and he hugged him. This is after, you know, the various groups have come with the gifts. This took place over a few days. Each group was a distance of one day apart from each other. So every day he was seeing a new group. With gifts and with messengers. So finally he spots Yaakov. Then, after all the gifts have passed by, the family. There's Yaakov at the head, and then he divided the wives with their children, you know, in separate groupings. And he runs. He can't control himself anymore. He's overcome by a tremendous emotion. He runs to greet him. I wonder how Yaakov felt in those few moments while he was running. He didn't know what he was running. This could be either good or bad. Vayechad Keo. And he hugged him. And he fell on his shoulders and he kissed him. And there are dots over the kiss. Vayivku, and they cried. They both cried. This is a very touching story. Reunion. It's a machlokas. No. It's a machlokas. Some say it indicates that it wasn't a whole heart kiss, and that even though he reconciled, it wasn't with a full heart. The others say it was with a full heart. That's a machlokas. So, what do we? Then he lifted up his eyes and he saw the women and the children, and he said, "Who are these to you?" And he said, "These are the children that God has mercifully bestowed upon your servants." And then the rest of the family comes close, and he says, "What?" Then he asks. This is even before he has accepted the gift. And he says in verse 8, "What is all of this camp that I see, that I've encountered? What are all these animals? What's all this wealth that I've encountered?" And then he says, "To find favor in the eyes of my master." It's only at this point that Yaakov tells him that they're really for him. And then Yaakov says, "Esav refuses." You see, he refuses. He actually, "Oh, I have a lot. My brother, you keep what's yours." And then he insists, and Yaakov insists, "No, please, don't refuse it." It's very difficult for Yaakov to... Of course, this is after Yaakov is safe now. They've had this tremendous reconciliation. He's safe, but Yaakov still insists that he takes the gift. Yeah, he wants him to take that gift. But you see, this only shows that, in retrospect, that it wouldn't have been that easy to get a man like him to take a gift. People don't want to take gifts anymore. And what are the strings? You know, what are the strings that are attached? Right. But what strikes me is verse 4. Isn't this an extreme reaction? Here's a man who said in his heart, "I'll wait for the days until my father dies, and I'll go out and I'll kill my brother Yaakov." So Esav intended to kill Yaakov. He had tremendous hatred for him, for what he had done. In his own frame of reference, he thought that Yaakov had done a tremendous harm to him. And what we would have hoped for, at least, was that he's willing not to kill him, let him live, so forth. That would have been fine. But here he goes to a tremendous extreme, a total transformation. You see, Lord, that's why I say it's more than just simply, you know, moving out of the material sphere, going back to the old. He has to bring about a tremendous transformation. And it was to the extent that he was overcome with emotion, and he kisses him, he hugs him, and he kisses him, and he cries. And then you see later on, he wants to stay with him. He doesn't want, he wants to stay with him permanently. So, what's going on over here? What happened? And because of the animals that he's seen? Because of his wealth? I'd like to analyze the crying a little bit. Well, it's an interesting question. Well, why did he cry? What caused the crying? What happened over here to cause him to cry? And what kind of a crying is it? It's interesting because we one time had a discussion about, you see, this very, you know, a strange psychological phenomenon. Crying is usually associated with sadness, with pain, right? Generally speaking, you cry because of something bad news. But isn't it ironic that people cry for joy as well? Didn't that ever strike you as being strange? That people... Two things which seem to be the exact opposite, though. A person will, sometimes people will cry at their wedding. Well, not, you know, it could be the dead, but it could also, be, usually, yes. Isn't it strange that, well, sometimes a person will win a championship, usually the champ, when a person achieves something, they'll cry too. Now, what is the crying? You have a why. When you're grateful, is it two separate things? I mean, is crying sadness or is crying happiness? Crying is something that, of course, it's emotional. You say, whenever I hear those kind of answers, I see that no one's really thought about
TES. Well, isn't this part of the brain that has to do with it?
Where else do we see? Yeah, but it's not openly depicted. Take a look at the reaction when he loses the brach, He doesn't exactly cry, but he comes very close to it. And then what's his reaction over there?
Frustration.
Hold it a second. He does cry. If you go back to Bereishis 27, when when Esav comes back from the hunt to prepare the food for his father, and he comes inside and he finds out that the brothers were given to Yaakov, so he has a very extreme reaction. Right? He says, when Esav, that's in verse 34, when Esav heard the words of his father, and he screamed, the mighty and bitter, exceedingly mighty and bitter, by Yitzhak to Akhar Gadol Umar Ad Ma'od. Yes, Mordechai. Very similar. Terrible frustration. Terrible, terrible reaction when he finds that he lost the brachos. Then in verse 38, and Esav said to his father, Habaracha achasi l'cha abi? Do you have, because Yitzchak tells him that that's it, he only has one bracha and he's lost it, he can't do anything for him. And then he pleads with him, do you have at least one bracha for me? He says, bless me also, my father. And he lifts, Vayisa Esav kola vayeich, and Esav lifted up his voice and he cried. So here too he cried. Now, my question is, how do you understand that? What caused this extreme, extreme reaction of Esav? Because he had not gotten the brachos. And basically the brachos he laid to the talash and the dew of the heavens, materialistic types of things. Is it simply, was he crying simply because of a monetary, materialistic kind of a loss? And he subsequently sees that he did pretty well for himself. He turned out to be quite wealthy and successful and so on and so forth. So how do we understand the mechanism? And I think that this is at the heart of understanding the strategy. The strategy of Yaakov. I think that Yaakov plans his strategy very, very carefully, and it was with a very deep insight into the whole nature of the animosity, of the hatred of Esav. Lori? What's that? The reaction of Esav and his hatred of Yaakov. As a result of this, as a result of the fact that he lost the blessing, he forms this tremendous hatred. I compare his reaction to the reaction of somebody else, and his desire to kill. Who do you in Bereshit? Who would you compare? Exactly, to Cain and Abel. To Cain and Abel. I think it's a very similar thing. What? You don't see the connection? In other words, I think that it wasn't so much the materialism itself, and it never is the materialism itself. See, materialism is really symbolic of something else. What caused him this tremendous thing was that he lost something which was more important to him. And he took it as a rejection of the Father. He lost the approval. Well, what was a very, you have to realize, the tremendous importance in the psyche of Esav. And that's why Esav could have gone either way. As long, by the way, as long as Avram was alive, he didn't sin. And then everything that he did, in spite of the fact that he was in Russia, he always took tremendous pain not to do things that would get Yitzchak angry with him. And what he saw in the whole conflict with Yaakov was that he recognized that that Yaakov had the approval.
And he showed him
up. That he had lost, the loss of the brachos meant the loss of the approval of his father, that his father had no respect for him, he couldn't tolerate that. He needed the approval. In order for a person like Esav to survive psychologically, his ego needed the approval of a tremendous superego figure, which was, in his case, was Yitzchak and Avram. I say it's similar to the case of Cain and Hevel. Because what caused Cain to turn against Hevel? The fact that God rejected his servant. And God intervenes and tells him, Lama Charalach, Lama Naflu Panecha. His face fell, which meant that he experienced depression. He was depressed. And he was angry. Now what's the anger? The anger is always because of one thing. He cannot face up with his own anger. In other words, the reason why does Esav hate Yaakov? Why does the guy hate the Jew? And we said the real thing is not because of materialism. Materialism can affect it, but the real underlying cause is God. It's the rejection by God. It's the fact that by choosing the Jew, the Gentile senses rejection. But rather than admit to his own shortcomings, because the truth of the matter is that the Gentiles could have had the Torah, and the Gentiles still can have the Torah, they can partake of Torah, rather than admit their own shortcomings, they say, no, there's nothing lacking in me, but it's his fault. It's a deflection of one's own inadequacy onto somebody else. That's exactly what happened with Cain and Hevel. Cain could not face up to his own inadequacy. The reason why God rejected his carbon was because of his own shortcomings, He had not chosen from the best. It was a defect in his karma. God pointed at him. Aharon, take it. If you do good, then your face will be uplifted. And in a similar way, Esav was really troubled. The real crying, the real loss, was the love of the father. But rather than face up to his own shortcomings, it's much easier to find the scapegoat. It's that trickster. It's that Yaakov. It's his fault. He's my enemy. And therefore, in his own mind, the only way he could be at peace, the only way, because see, Yaakov has the love. And as long as Yaakov exists, it's a reproach to him. He has the love, I know. That was the underlying basis of the hatred. And I think that this is what Yaakov sought to, this is how Yaakov sought to undo it. Because Yaakov was also a person whom Esav had the potential to respect. As long as Yaakov was Yaakov, and love and garti, as long as the Tayag Mitzvah Shamarti, so he partook of that quality of being the superego as well. That's the point. The idea of the gift was not a bribe. It was not a payoff. It was not, leave me alone and I'll pay you alone, at all. It was an attempt to give Esav that which he craved the most. What does he crave the most? The respect and honor. From who? From somebody like that. That's why, that'll explain why everything was planned out very, very carefully. The gift itself was designed with tremendous care, what he selected. And also it was done very dramatically. He didn't just give it in one shot. Here, take it. Everything reflected care, planning the amount of males and females in terms of, you know, which animal be chosen, how many males, for how many females, for reproduction, and so on and so forth. And then in the spacing, Lahatzpia, you know, to catch his attention. So he used the elements of drama, of arousing his sense of suspense, Esav. And most important of all, you see, for example, it's interesting to know, there's a lot of questions over here. He sent it with various groups, and he instructed every group to repeat a message. Now, why did every group have to repeat the same message? Well, you have to reinforce. They all repeated the same message. What was the message? Take a look at the Chumash over here. Right, exactly. He instructed every group, when Esav meets you, and he asks you, who are you from, and where are you going, and what are all these before you? So you should say they belong to your servant Yaakov, and it's a gift that he has sent to my master Esav. He always refers to him as my master Esav. And behold, he's coming after us. So he commanded the second and the third and all the groups to say these very same words when they encountered Esav. And then he said, Luke 22:21, and you shall say, behold, your servant Yaakov is after us, for he has said, I will achapra panav. Now, there's a whole argument over there how you're supposed to read it. Now, Rashi says that this is not what he said, but that's what Yaakov thought. I will abolish his anger. Achapra panav means I will abolish his anger with the present. Ramban disagrees. Ramban says there's no point for the pasuk to tell us that the motivation of Yaakov was to abolish his anger. But he says, no, that this is what the messenger was supposed to say. That the messenger was supposed to say to Esav, Ki Omar, Achapra Panav, Bamincha Hacholechet, Lepanav, Viachare Chayar Panav, Ula Yisa Panai. The Ramban explains this to mean that they were supposed to say that Yaakov is coming after us in an expression of honor in this manner. Also, behold, your servant Yaakov is after us, and he has sent us before him. And the word achapra is from kofar. Kofar is like an atonement, kapara. But it also has the sense that you get that, that's right. In other words, that it is an expression of honor for the fact that a great man is willing to receive me. That the entire purpose of this gift is, you wouldn't go to see a king empty-handed. You can't do that. If you have the the chus, the merit to see a great individual or to have an appointment with the president or to see a king, you have to bring something with you to show the honor and respect. That the mere fact that he's willing to receive me demands that I give a tremendous a gift to this individual as a sign of honor and respect and appreciation that he's going to see me. That's what the that's what he says, that the messengers were instructed to explain to Asa that this is the purpose. That behold, this has been sent. By the way, the Sforza points out that the reason why each group was supposed to tell him this was so that Esav shouldn't think that he's giving this because he knows. In other words, that Yaakov knows that Esav is coming out to get him, so that he's giving the gift in response. In other words, they were supposed to give the impression that Yaakov was going on his own, of his own volition. Not that he knew that Esav was coming, but Yaakov was going of his own volition to go and meet him. And this was something that he had decided upon on his own. See, that's why it's very important. If Esav thinks that Yaakov knows that I'm coming against him, and this is a strategy, then the whole thing is of no value. So the point of these messengers was to prepare the way, that they're trying to establish the possibility for Yaakov to have a meeting with Esav, and that the whole purpose is because this is the greatest thing that he craves in his life, is to have a meeting with someone whom he looks up to and whom he regards as being on the level of a king, and that it's worth it for him. It's worth it for him to give all of this materialism, all of this wealth, just to have a meeting with this one individual. That was the whole purpose of the gift. And there's one further element. What's the further element? The seven balance. When you saw him bow seven times. See? Why does that show? You see, what is the seven balance? He's giving a bribe. What's the seven balance? The seven balance shows the tremendous honor and respect that he has for Esau. See? So, that was the whole point. In other words, the whole point was to remove the cause of the hatred that Esau had for Yaakov. And he did it basically in two ways. In other words, the envy that he had was based on the fact that Yaakov had been chosen for the blessings and he was rejected. So he diffused that. The blessings have not been fulfilled within me, you see. That's one thing. But then, see, there's something else that the Russia cannot tolerate. He senses that there's a certain superiority. We mentioned before. He senses that superiority in the Tzaddik. The Tzaddik has something superior. He has the knowledge. He has the Torah. He has the approval of God. Now, that causes him to feel inferior. Now, whenever the Tzaddik acts in such a way that it appears as though he has a certain complacency, a smugness, a certain arrogance about it, that he really does feel superior, that he really does look down upon the Russia, the Russia can't tolerate. He cannot tolerate that feeling of being looked down upon, of being inferior. And what he needs the most is to have the respect of the Jew. That's an amazing kind of a thing. Yes, and Goyim will complain about that a lot, that the Jews only care about their own, that they have no respect when they're amongst themselves. They have no respect, you know, for other people. They feel superior to other people. Now, this really bothers the Gentile. Why does it bother you so much? There are a lot of people. There, you know, the French feel superior and so on and so forth. But it doesn't cause anti-Frenchism. See, I know that the French consider themselves superior to others. It doesn't bother me at all. Why? Because I don't regard them as being superior. That's something else. They regard them as being annoying. But you see, you sense that. They do partake of that. But it's not, because deep down, nobody really believes. Nobody gives it any credence. But with the Jew, it has credence. From Sinai, can you show me at the Sinai, l'chola olam? There is a part of the Gentile that recognizes the truth. And if it wasn't, Freud said this, ever since the Jews declared 2,000 years ago that they were the chosen people, so the rest of the world has acted as though deep down they really believe it. The persecution is based upon the fact that deep down they really believe it. So once they believe that, So if the Jew shows respect, so the Jew becomes the superego of the world now. See? The Jew becomes Al Hashem the Al Mashiach. It says in Tehillim that why have the nations gathered? Anti-Semitism is against Hashem and His Anointed One. The hatred of the Jew is a hatred of God. The Jew represents God, the way of God. It's a hatred of the superego. So therefore, that creates the opening. And that is that when the Jew shows genuine respect and honor for the guy, and he refuses to indulge in a feeling of superiority, then that disarms the Jew. It's a very important lesson. I believe that that's the lesson that one of the lessons, of course, I can't say the lesson. All right, but as we say, that throughout these centuries, whenever the rabbis had to meet with the Gentile authorities, they went through this parsha. And it's more than just, because this is an idea, not just an idea you have to know in the abstract, but you always have to examine yourself. It's something that really afflicts the Jew, the feeling of superiority. Jews do partake of this feeling of superiority, and they base it upon the fact that we are superior. Not realizing that if you partake of this, it's going to affect, and even if you try and hide, it's very hard to hide, it's very hard to cover it up, and they do look down upon Gaia. And when that attitude comes through, it causes tremendous problems. On the other hand, when the Gentiles, there's nothing that can bring, that's what the crying was about. I think Laurie said it very well, it's bracketed. The crying is always for sadness. The first crying was for the sadness, was for the loss. The loss of that a feeling of respect from his father. But after that, he had to repress it. See, when a person cries, let me just explain psychologically, when a person cries for joy, it means that he's really crying. So crying is only because of sadness, because of a loss. What does it mean he cries for joy? When a person's been struggling and straining for years to achieve something, so then he has to hold in check all of these emotions. His needs, he has to cover them up, he has to hold them in check. But when finally the encounter of Yaakov with Esau. This is a very important story, as you know. This is a very important story. It's interesting to note that I remember hearing this always, you know, in yeshiva, that this represents the classical encounter between the Jew and the Gentile. So that throughout history, whenever the Jewish leaders had to meet with the Gentiles because of the situation of persecution or whatever, so they would always take out this part to prepare themselves. They'd always take out this portion, this story to learn the ideas, how to deal with the anti-Semites. So hopefully, if we can really analyze it, we can find out some of the deeper ideas. Now, if you've gone through the story, it begins, in other words, as you know, Yaakov is returning from his sojourn with Laban. He's been away from home for about 22 years. And, of course, when he left, he knew that Esau was extremely angry at him and wanted to kill him. So now he's returning, and he anticipates the encounter with Esau. Apparently he would have to pass by the area, the general area where Esau was staying. So the first part is he sends out messengers before him to Esau, his brother, which is very interesting in its own right. He anticipates the situation. At this stage of the game, Esau is not even aware that Yaakov is coming. But Yaakov doesn't wait for the situation of danger to arise. Ramban, in fact, criticized him for doing this. But nevertheless, we'll have to see. Yaakov sends out messengers to his brother Esau. That's phase one, with a specific message. Then the messengers return. That's in Pasuk Zion 7. By Yeshuvu HaMalachim, the messengers return. And they, this pasuk itself is not that easy to understand. They say, "We've come to your brother Esav, and he is going out to meet you with 400 men with him." And then it says, "And Yaakov was extremely afraid," and then he goes into his plan of action. But it doesn't say, what's very interesting about this is that the Torah does not record the meeting between the messengers and Esau. It tells you what Yaakov told the messengers, and the messengers come back. We have no idea what happened between the messengers and Esau. And we have no idea, in fact, why Yaakov is greatly frightened. Vayira Yaakov Ma'od. Yaakov was extremely frightened. Vayetelo, he's extremely distressed. And then he divides the people and so on. Then he launches his plan. So we'll break it up into two phases. We'll break it up into the first phase. What was the objective of sending out these messengers? What was the message? What was he planning to, what was he hoping to accomplish? And secondly, after they come back, and he's very much afraid, the second phase. In other words, he ultimately, as we know, he did succeed. Ultimately, as we know, he succeeded, and he was able to appease his brother. But we want to understand the tactics that he used and so forth, the psychology. There's an interesting Ramban at the beginning. The Ramban introduces this parsha by saying that the purpose of this parsha was lodia, to let us know that God saves his servant and redeems him from the one who is stronger than him. In other words, that this is the purpose of the parsha, to let us know that God redeems his servant. And he sends an angel and saves him. And it teaches us also that he, lo batach tzidkato, that Yaakov did not rely upon his righteousness. He didn't feel complacent because of his tzidkus, his righteousness. And hishtadel batzalo, b'chol yecholto, and he made great efforts to save himself. He did whatever was possible. The Yeshba Od Remez Ladoro, it also contains a hint for future generations. For everything which occurred to our father, with Esav, his brother, occurs to us constantly with the children of Esav. So this is also a paradigm. It's also supposed to be a model for the future. And it is fitting for us to seize the way of the Tzaddik, that we should prepare ourselves for three things that he prepared himself for. For prayer, for diplomacy, and for fighting, for war. Alright? The first part of the story. So it says, Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lefanav. Yaakov sent messengers before him to his brother Esav, to the land of Seir, the field of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, thus shall you say to my master Esav, thus says your servant Jacob, in Lavan Garti, I dwelled, I tarried with Lavan, ve'echarata, and I was delayed until now. I stayed there until now. And I have had a shor v'chamor, oxen and donkeys and sheep, servants, male servants, female servants, and I have sent forth to tell my master in order to find favor in your eyes. That was the message. Alright? So, what was the purpose behind the message? What was the idea? What was the key phrase over here? Toamar Avdecha Yaakov, thus said your servant Yaakov, in love on Garki v'echar adata. So what's he saying? He's afraid that Esav is angry at him and Esav wants to kill him. So it's a very small, it's a very short kind of message. It doesn't say much. What's he trying to achieve with this? Good idea. Laurie is saying that it's really not a message of to appease him so much. That's the question, in other words. Is the objective of this message one of appeasement, or is it one of warning? No, the way you're saying, it's sort of a diplomatic.
It's diplomatic,
but the point is to let him know, if you think I'm an easy target, that's
right.
Not the case. I came.
Right.
So it's a message of strength.
Right.
I never thought of it that way. I never looked at it that way. And I don't know that Rashi looks at it your way. But
I think he says,
it does make sense. In other words, I'm not the same guy I was. I'm not the Yoshi of Ohalam in love on Garchi. In other words, I've hung around with some tough customers. And I've gone through a lot of experiences.
I've maintained that the system that I lived with in the first place was correct. In other words, not because that I lived with him, but I never became one of him. In other words, I've kept it.
So, take a look at Rashi. Garchi, in love on Garchi. The term Garchi means temporary. It implies temporary as well. Ger is a stranger. I sojourned with love on. So why do you use that term? So he says, Lo nasisi sar v'chasha. I didn't become a ruler or an important person. El a ger. But I'm just a ger, I'm just a stranger. Ein chokadai lisno osu. I'm not fit for you to hate me. I'll birkos avicha, concerning the blessings of your father, Sheberachni, who blessed me, have gvir lachecha, that you would be a ruler unto your brother. Sharei lo niskaima bi, because they were not fulfilled through me. That's the first pshat. In other words, the expression of ger, in love on Garchi, according to Rashi, is meant to let him know that I didn't become an important person. I didn't attain any position of prominence or power. That's what he's telling you. That's what Rashi says. Davar Acher. The next shot, then Rashi's Davar Acher, a different shot. Rashi mentions this shot, but he says as a separate shot. Davar Acher, Garchi, Begmatria, Tayyad. The word Garchi equals Tayyad. Tafresh, Yud Gimel, same letter, which is 613. Kalamar, in love with Harosha, Garchi. That is to say, I lived with Lavan the Russia, the wicked one, the Tayag Mitzvah Shamarti, and I kept the 613 commandments. And I did not learn from this wicked way. Let's focus on that for a minute. Some of you may have analyzed this before. What, in other words, according to Rashi, there's an implication over here. There's a overt message in the statement. Then there's a covert message. Of course, the overt message is in love on Garchi, the word I dwelled with love on. But Garchi, Bigmatri Tayyad, there was the point that you're making. He wanted to indicate something else to him, that in spite of that fact, he kept mitzvot. Now the question is, what was the psychology behind that? That was in other words, he wants to defuse the anger of an Esav. Esav is a wicked person. He wants to let him know that he's an individual who still keeps Torah, in spite of the fact that he dwells with love. Now, would that be a wise thing to do with the anti-Semite, to let him know that you're firmly committed to keeping the Torah? Now, I could think of a contradiction. There's a statement of Chazal that would seem to contradict it. That what is the cause of anti-Semitism?
Oh, because they know where the truth
is. Sinai.
Right.
Because I'll say that, why is the mountain called Har Sinai? Ki misham yotza sina l'chala olam. Because from Sinai went forth hatred to the entire world. What does that mean? That means that that bottom line, in spite of everything else, Chazal is saying that there's many causes for anti-Semitism, but the most underlying cause is Torah. When God gave, that's why the mountain is called Sinai. It's a play on words, but indicating an idea. When God gave the Torah to the Jews, so then he automatically created a situation of sinner. And the real sinner for the Jew is over Torah. Of course, it might seem strange that the rest of the world is envious of us because of Torah. Because it doesn't seem like the rest of the world is really interested in the Torah, or respects Torah, or would want to keep Torah. How do you explain that? I mean, how many? That is Chazal, which contradicts another Chazal. What's the third Chazal now? What's the third statement that the second one contradicts? I agree with Lori. Because Chazal is saying that Misham Yotzei Sinu L'Chol HaOlam, that the Torah, the fact that God gave the Jews Torah, created sinner, which means there's a jealousy about Torah. But this would fly in the face of another statement of Chazal,
Chazal say that that God, before he gave the Jews the Torah, went to all the nations and offered them the Torah, and each one asked, well, what's in the Torah? They got lost six old eyes, you can't steal, you can't commit adultery, and so on, you can't murder, and they all rejected it. And when God came to the Jews, what did the Jews say? Na'aseh v'nishma. So it just seems to be a contradiction. According to this Chazal, the Gentiles had an opportunity to receive Torah and rejected it. They didn't want to be part of Torah. If that is the case, what is meant by the fact that they became envious of the Jews and they hated the Jews because they were given the Torah? What it means, you have to look at a person's psychology at a deeper level. You can't. People's real attitudes are not always reflected in their conscious decisions. That is to say, that the average person observes the Jews, and today there's a lot of mingling in our society. I mean, you get to observe Gentiles, and Gentiles get to observe Jews. And sometimes it's in the workplace, you make friends, they get invited. You invite them to a bar mitzvah or whatever, a wedding, and they get to see. Or they even go to a fair. They get to see the Jewish customs. And they're really impressed by, the amount of effort that Jews have to put into keeping the mitzvahs when it comes to, keeping their kosher home and kashrus and that. And, the basic guys do is, boy, it's a lot of work. And they wouldn't want to have to be burdened by all these things. However, deep down, there's a tremendous respect. I think, you see, when, you're right, when God offered them the Torah, so the basic instinct was to turn it down, because they don't want to be saddled with it. Everybody has the idea that happiness lies with instinctual freedom. There shouldn't be any restraints on the instinct. It's a false idea, but that's the basic idea. I don't want to have a system where I'm restrained. What causes the envy, though, is that the people know there's something unique about the Jews. And even though what's unique about the Jewish Torah, the Chachma, the wisdom, and that's why there's envy over Torah. Even if an individual is himself not involved in Chachma, and he lives like a behemoth, but since he's human, and he has a reality principle, a certain part of him recognizes that this is the higher part of man. See? And that's it's an interesting kind of a thing. You see it, for example, even in Mitzrayim, when Yaakov died. When Yaakov died, they showed greater recognition for Yaakov than they did for Yosef. And Yosef had been the ruler and had saved the nation. But Yaakov had a greater mystique in terms of being the man, the Yisrael Elokim, the man of God. Right. So, therefore, even though the ones who get the attention today are the people in the public eye and the stars and so on and so forth. But there's a separate respect. What's that? But there's a separate respect for like an Einstein, for a truly great scholar, people recognize that that's where the true greatness is. So therefore, the meaning is that they had great envy for the Jews, because deep down the Gentile recognizes that the highest part of man is really the mind, and that the Jew is superior. The Jew has something which they do not have. Now, the proof of the envy, of course, it would be in the existence of Christianity. The major, it's not coincidental, but the two major religions besides Judaism are all founded upon the truth, the veracity of the Old Testament. And they all have the same basic idea. Neither one of them denies that the Jews are the chosen people. And they all claim that the Jews were chosen, but they have been superseded by another people. Both groups. That's the essence, if Christianity, if anything, is affirming that deep down they really believe that the Jews are the chosen ones. They affirm it through their denial. But of course, they can't tolerate the idea. It's a special mission to convert Jews. Well, it was a whole system. They couldn't tolerate the idea that they were left out, that they were rejected. It's based upon the inability to accept the fact. So therefore they changed around the entire thing, and the Jews weren't worthy, and so on and so forth, and they supplanted them. And it's the same basic idea with Islam. Now, if that's the case, So we have to analyze the deeper message. Now, what was the psychology of Yaakov? If the essential, the underlying cause, is the fact that the Gentiles feel inferior because the Jews have Torah, and that so why bring it up? Why throw it in his face at this moment? This is the time when you wouldn't mention Torah. You follow? In other words, on the basis of our analysis, what Yaakov did does not make any sense, because he was trying to set up a situation to diffuse the anger. If the bottom line, if the underlying cause, well, you see, this is even before Matan Torah, but Esav realized that he felt inferior to Yaakov, because Yaakov, even though Esav was a man of the field, but Yaakov was the Yoshev Oholam, was involved in Torah. And if Torah is the cause, and he followed the mitzvah, if that's the cause of the resentment, so why would he flaunt it? Why would he tell him that he still keeps the system of Tariyak? Why not just forget about it? Why bring it up? The best thing is not to mention it. That's the question. It's always important to indicate to your opponent that you're a person of principle, because people tend to respect a person of principle, even if they don't agree with them. That happens to be a good point. I mean, people respect the Jew. Well, that's what it ties in with what we're saying, what Jackie was saying. This is what we said. In other words, that it's an ironic situation that, on the one hand, it is true that the Gentile hates the Jew. An interesting statement later on about anti-Semitism. We're going to come back to this later. I'm just going to mention it right now. Turn briefly now to Lama Gimel. Perek, excuse me, Pesach Dalet. I don't know if we'll answer this now. I'll just bring up the issue to think about it. Because this is later on. This is after he sends him this tremendous gift, and he breaks it up, and they go in stages and so forth. He wins Esav over. And Esav ran to meet him, Vayechav Keu, and he hugs him. He was amazed. I mean, the plan of Yaakov was tremendously successful. He turned him over completely. And he fell on his shoulders. Vayishakeu, and he kissed him. Vayiftu, and they cried. Now, if you take a look at the word Vayishakeu, you see there's dots over it. Now, the dots have a meaning. It's part of the Masorah. What's the meaning of those dots? So if you take a look at Rashi, you ain't seen Machlokas. Rashi says, Vayishakeu nokadolo. There are dots on it. The Yesh Chokim, the Dava Hazeb, the Vrash, the Sefri. There's an argument concerning this. Yesha Darshan of Kudazu, Lomar, Shoanashka Bahalilo. There are those who interpret this dot to indicate that it wasn't a full hearted, he didn't kiss him with all of his heart. He did not kiss him with all of his heart. Reb Shimon ben Yochai said, Halachahi. It is a halacha. The Yadua, it's known, She Esav Sonei Liyakov, that Esav hates Yaakov. But he was overcome, his mercy went out to him at that time, and he kissed him with his entire heart. So that's a very interesting idea in the reconciliation. There's a machlokas, whether he kissed him with all of his heart or not, but we'll get back to that later. But the point is, the statement, the famous statement of Rav Shimon ben Yochai, halachahi, it's a halacha that Esav hates, I'm sure you've heard this thing before, halacha, it's a law, it's like a Torah law, Esav hates Yaakov. That's it. You know, what does that mean? That would seem to indicate that the hatred of Esav, or anti-Semitism, is a law of nature. What do you mean by the expression halacha? It's a law of nature, it's a natural phenomenon. Right? Now, what does that mean? If that's the case, then what, the situation can never change, and what's the purpose of the story, and why study the parsha and all the strategies that he's employing? He says it's a halacha. It's a halacha. It's a law of nature. That's right. What's going to happen to the halacha then? Good question. So what does it mean halacha? I always wanted to take that up. What does it mean halacha?
The
Yadua. No, if it's a given, then there's no, you know, they have no control over it. It's a natural thing. It's a natural phenomenon.
If it's a natural phenomenon, that's an instinctual thing.
Halacha means that the hatred doesn't just come about by accident. It's not an accidental phenomenon. You know, if you understand all of the factors, if you understand human nature, the way people function, the way the emotions are set up, you'll understand why it just has to be, given the situation, it has to be that way. You have a world, you have a universe, man being the way he is, and ki bachar banu mikol ha'anim, and God, who is the Supreme Father, because the entire world recognizes that there is a God, whatever their concept of God, or whatever their idea of how to relate to God, but everybody has an idea of God. And the idea that God chooses one nation from other nations, if you understand this, and you know, the basis, apparently the basis of Torah and Sinai is so powerful that the entire world believes it. And that's something you should take to heart, because this phenomenon of anti-Semitism is itself a tribute to the fact that people are convinced that something happened. Believe me, I mean, if any nation got the fact that the Jews regard themselves as being different and special, if any other nation, there are other nations that may, the French think of themselves as being superior and elite, but it never created a phenomenon of anti-Frenchism, like anti-Semitism. And the Jews are why? And there are other people in the world that consider themselves to be terrific. Like every people has a certain ego. The Italians, you know, for their, I don't know what, for their, for their qualities, right? Other nations. If a nation should arise in Asia or in Africa, whatever it is, claiming that they're divine, that they're special, that God picked them out, I guarantee you would not cause the same effect, because nobody would be impressed. Nobody would believe it. You see, people believe it. It's due to two things. It's due to the fact that it happened in such a way, you see, the entire world accepted the phenomenon. It's impossible. It's impossible for the people to manufacture a story like this, that the entire nation was, it's part of our history. It doesn't exist in any other people, but it's part of their history that the entire nation was gathered and God spoke to them. So this is unique, and it's in the nature of the Jew himself. The Jew is special, the Jew is different. There's no other people that has this kind of a history, that the tremendous intellectual development of the Jews, the teachings of the Jewish people, their historical experience, what they've gone through in history. And this is even before, but, you know, our times when we've been exiled from our land and dispersed and everybody tried to destroy us, and somehow the Jews not just survived, but thrived. And in every country, the Jew was always on the, was always the pioneer in terms of advancement in every area. It's an amazing phenomenon. So the Gentile recognizes the uniqueness in these two facts, in the character of the Jew and in the events of Sinai. So this causes, the fact of the matter is then, if this is the case, it's a halacha. You can't have such a phenomenon that this people is different, this people has been benefited with the Torah, the other nations will have a natural predisposition to hate them. That's the halacha. That means a natural predisposition. Given the ordinary flow of human emotion in an unperfected state, that people are in an unperfected state, and all people recognize that wisdom, knowledge is the greatest thing, and to have a relationship with God, to be chosen by God, is the greatest thing. I one time saw the, you know, occasionally on Sunday, this is years ago though, today they have all these preachers on TV, but there was this one guy, I just happened to catch it, he was, I think, from Belgium. And he was, you know, one of these preachers and whatever. But he was talking about the Bible, and he was telling the people, he was trying to convince them that if you truly follow the Word of God, you know, you have to accept that the Old Testament is true. He says there's one idea that Christians don't accept, but it's one theme that is repeated throughout the Old Testament, the prophets, and so on. There's no way, how could you accept this book and deny it? And that is that God does have a chosen people. Because now I'm from Belgium. I wish that God had chosen the Belgian people. I really wish. I mean, because I would love to be part of the Jewish people. But if you read the Torah, it's not the case. God has a chosen people, and the chosen people are the Jews. They are the chosen people. That bothers me. I don't like it. But if I'm going to be honest, I have to accept it. I mean, he's like an honest kind of guy. Except the Old Testament, the prophets, B'nei B'chor Yisrael, my son, my firstborn is Israel. I mean, you can't deny that. If you deny that, you deny the whole Torah. That isn't going to cause envy. He's admitting that this causes envy. But he's on a high level. He's on a higher level, so he doesn't give in to the envy because he recognizes it. But that's the halacha. The halacha means that it creates a certain natural tendency. However, what the Rashi is saying over here is that in spite of this natural tendency, in order for the... You see, there's also a respect for the Jew. Envy goes along side by side with respect. There's the envy, there's dislike. What's that? That's right. There's the envy, there's the dislike, there's the hatred, there's the desire to destroy, but there's also something which is holding him back. The fear, you mentioned that. I mean, he respects the Jew, and he fears God. If he didn't have a fear of God, then he wouldn't be envious of the Jew. All these things go together. So that there's something which is holding the hatred in check. Therefore, the question arises, even though we say it's a halacha, it's a fact of nature, we still have to ask the question, does the behavior of the Jew play a role in bringing anti-Semitism to the fore? Now, the Jews like to portray themselves. There's a certain Jewish mentality which likes to portray itself. We're just victims. In other words, there are good, right? In other words, the Jewish press kind of mentality. Very rarely is there any self-criticism. All the bad things that happen to the Jews in the world, of course, it's because there's Goyim, and Goyim are basically anti-Semitism, so that's why, and Jews are good. In other words, if you read it, you know, that type of mentality, all Jews are basically good. Right? Of course, except those Jews that don't keep the Torah, but that's within our own. That's within our own realm, but that doesn't cause anti-Semitism. All Jews are basically good. All Goyim are basically bad, except for those few, you know, who are righteous and who recognize that we are the chosen people. Therefore, what? All of us, yeah. Therefore, all the sufferings that the Jews go through is simply because of the evil of the government. If I said, that's the halacha, there's nothing we can do about it. Very rarely is there ever an attempt in these types, you ever read, you know, in any publication today, really a self-analysis, what are the things that Jews do to really elicit it, to bring out anti-Semitism to the fore? Now this Rashi is saying that even though it's a halacha, the fact that it's a halacha, it's a natural force, it doesn't mean to say that it must express itself. In order for it to express itself, it requires certain conditions. And the Jew does have a very, very powerful impact upon whether it's allowed to express itself. Because while it's there, it's being held in check by the factor of respect and by the factor of fear. So therefore, what he was saying is like this, that as long as the Jew stands a much better chance when he stays in his own realm. If the Jew keeps the Torah, and he didn't just say Vitayak Mitzvah Shamarti, like many Jews keep the Torah in America today, in other words, just a perfunctory performance of the mitzvah, but his whole value system is materialistic. You see, there are two shulchanos, so to speak. There are two tables that one can partake of. You know, there's the table of materialism, and then there's the table of, you know, Gashmiah, so to speak, materialism, and Ruchniah. People recognize there are two goods one can pursue. There's the materialistic goods, and then there's the spiritualistic goods. Deep down, what a person really respects is the person who has the spiritualist. He recognizes that stuff. Because he senses that all these things are an illusion. He senses that. He senses. The wealthy, the Maxwells, all these guys, they appear. They appear to be great, but it's illusions. Eventually, the illusion is broken down. And when the expose is today, you know, everybody has an expose and a biography. Eventually, you find out what the guy was really like. You know, to his servants, just, you know, he's not such a great man to his servants. They know the real person. But what people know is really everlasting and permanent is the spiritual. So they respect the spiritual. However, They can tolerate the fact that the Jew, see, how do they deal with the fact that the Jew was singled out and given the greatest good of all, which is Torah? How can they tolerate that? Yeah, because they feel that they have not been left out of the picture entirely. We also have something. We have this world. And, you know, most people's conscious attention is focused on the goods of this world. So that's a satisfaction. All right, so the Jew is sitting there in his little abode, and he's studying Torah. Let him study Torah the whole day. Meanwhile, we have the whole world is ours. We can enjoy the physical world. So as long as that's the case, as long as the Gentile has his compensation, that he can enjoy the physical world, so then he can accept the fact that the Jew has a spiritual good. All right, that's just a deep down kind of a feeling. What happens, however, when the Jew who we envy, because the Jew is given the Torah, suddenly doesn't just stay with the Torah, but he enters into the other realm as well, and he outdoes him in the realm of the material as well. And not only does he outdo him in that realm, purely because, it would be bad enough if he would outdo him purely because of his superior talent, but in doing so, he has some taints about him. In other words, some of the deals aren't entirely kosher, aren't entirely ethical, and so on and so forth. So then the hatred comes out. That's the worst scenario. Because the hatred is really there all along, except the hatred has been submerged, because there's an overriding layer of respect, and then there's fear, and there are three things. There's the respect, there's the fear, and then there's the compensation. That, all right, so I've been denied the spiritual, but at least I have this world. But when he loses, when he senses that the Jew is an enemy, and the Jew is a threat and a competition, and he also is able to justify his hatred of the Jew, there's no fear. He has fear of God, but there's no fear if the Jew is not keeping the Torah. If the Jew is an unethical person, so then he has no reason to fear him. He has no reason to respect him. Then all the barriers which have been holding the hatred in check are suddenly removed. And that's exactly why it was essential. It was essential for Yaakov to make known to Esav the Tayag Nitzashamad, that you should not think that I changed my ways. As long as he retains this picture of Yaakov who's dedicated to Torah and keeping the mitzvot, below Limarti Mimasav Haroyim. He mentions that too. I did not learn from his bad ways. Why do you have to mention both things? Of course, the first is keeping Tariag mitzvot, then he's not doing Mimasav Haroyim, he's not doing bad deeds. Why does he mention both? Yeah, exactly. It means to say that I'm not just keeping the Tariag mitzvot in a perfunctory way. I mean, Jews in America today, even Orthodox Jews, are very meticulous. Right? Very, very, meticulous in terms of how they... But that doesn't necessarily mean that the values are the right values. He means to say, I'm not just a Jew in terms of being, you know, religiously scrupulous, but I have not accepted his philosophy, his value system. I have retained my own value system. That is extremely important. So therefore, psychologically, he's keeping in place all of those factors which hold back the anti-Semitism. That was one essential component. Now, that for Jews to become successful materialistically is not so bad. We know, like an outside today, the Jews are successful disproportionately. Much more so than other groups. Minority groups are all, have tough times. But the Jews are extremely successful. The Jews are successful, it depends on what they do with their wealth and how they use their wealth. If they use their wealth for good purposes, and they share it, they do tzedakah and they give some tzedakah to the guy, and they don't flaunt it. The worst thing of all is to flaunt it, because that's what they want. In other words, if you have wealth, like, for example, Avraham had great wealth, the idea of Jews having wealth, I want to make that point, the idea of Jews having wealth to say is not necessarily bad, is not going to cause anti-Semitism, can be used for the good. You see, the Avos, Avraham was very wealthy. The Avos, Yaakov was very wealthy. To have wealth to say, and that was necessary for their mission, it's only if it's only if you flaunt the wealth. If you flaunt the wealth and you act towards it as though this is the great thing, and I really have it and you don't, then you make the Gentile feel inferior. You make it feel like nothing. You're flaunting it. You're using your money to buy beautiful houses and cars and so on and so forth. But if you live humbly, and you you reflect an attitude that you have this wealth and it's doing nothing to you. It's not even important to you. And the only value it has is to help people and do good deeds the world around them.
People are not envious. You see, people always like to mention, from what I've read about the Reichmans, for example, that they live very, very modestly. They're extremely wealthy, but they drive an ordinary car and they live in an ordinary hand. That's what I heard. In other words, the entire objective of this method was to diffuse the anger by removing the jealousy. And like Ramban says, everything that I've achieved so far, the blessings of material wealth, first of all, he's saying it hasn't been achieved in me. And everything that you might be envious of, the whole point is not the flaw. I have nothing that you could possibly be envious of. Because power, that's the thing that you care about, it wasn't achieved in me. I was a gift, Garki. I've been nothing up until, that's why he says, Eicharata, I've tired until now. All these many years, you think I've had it good? I've been a ruler, I've been a king. I've been a stranger, an outcast, an outsider. And as far as my relationship with you is concerned, I regard you as the elder brother. Ramban says that's an extremely important point, that I still regard you as the Bechor, as the firstborn, entitled to all of the respect. The only change with regard to the birthright, you sold it to me or whatever it is, but I don't regard that as creating any change in our relationship. I still regard myself as Avdecha, as your servant. So he's humble. It's a very important point we'll see later on. Now, why did he mention the specific animals? Vahili Shor Vachamor, why did he have to tell him all that? This would seem to be out of place. Why does he have to describe what he's got, his possessions? He don't mention that. He doesn't have to mention that now. He should have simply stopped. He has to mention Shor HaChamor, Tzom Diev B'Shifra. This sounds like he's got a lot of acquisitions. But Rashi points out, Laura, you going to do Rashi?
Oh, I don't
know. He also points out that the things that I have do not partake of the blessing that our father gave me. Abba Amar Alim Tal HaShemayim Lishmani Aret. The blessings were from the dew of the heavens and the fatness of the land. In other words, you know, harvest, the pro-right, the wealth of the land and that kind of thing, agriculture. Zu ain't a lomen ashamayim v'lomen aret. So therefore what he meant to say was, I don't regard that the blessings have been fulfilled for me. So you can feel at ease. In other words, there's no cause for you to feel that envy. And it's an interesting thing. It tells you about the psychology of the Russian. But so what's the difference? But he hates Yaakov because Yaakov has the blessing, right? Now Yaakov is not saying that it's false, that I renounce the blessing. All Yaakov is saying is that it has not been fulfilled today. But so what? But so why would that affect Yaakov? But it hasn't been fulfilled today, but maybe it'll be fulfilled soon. He lives in the present. He lives in the world. Where else do you see another example of that? See, the Rush, yes, now the Rush functions. The Rush does not function in the world of the abstract. You see that by Lavan, but you see it by Haman. Haman, whenever the Chalei, whenever I see, the Chalei and the Shavalei, right, all this is worth nothing to me every time I see Mordechai a Yehudi. And why? Because Mordechai won't give him any honor. So the fact is, one person, let's say he wouldn't see him. Why would it make any difference if he wouldn't see him? Then it wouldn't bother him. But he still knows that in reality, the answer is he doesn't live in the world of abstract reality. He lives in the world of the senses. It's only by what affects the senses at the moment. So that's what he's telling. That's what he's telling Esav. There's no reason. Yes. In other words, if Esav does not see anything, then he'll deny the reality of the bracha. For Esav, the reality of the bracha is not in the abstract. It's not in the abstract. Maybe it won't come true. Maybe it's all a dream. So all he has to do is to convince him that nothing concrete has happened. See, Yaakov is completely batua. Yaakov has complete confidence it's going to happen. It doesn't have to happen now. It could happen a few generations from now. So that's the entire objective. To defuse any envy that he might have for him. Well, we'll soon find. In the end, it does work. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll take that up. But there's one more thing. Let's just finish the message for today. We'll take up the next part message. This is Eshcha Lahagid Ladoni, and I sent forth to tell my master, Limso Chen Yenecha. That's also part of the message. Limso Chen Yenecha. What does that mean? To find favor. To find favor in your eyes. In your eyes. Shani Shalinimfa Umavakesh Avasta. And I'm seeking your love. That was a very important thing. That was a very important thing. What was he doing with that statement? Yeah. In other words, what's he telling him? First he's removing a lot of factors. There's no reason for you to envy me. Negative. Removal of negative. Right? Because I still regard you as I'm your servant. You're still the elder brother. I have not attained any power. I have nothing that you would envy. I have not attained any power. I have not attained the fulfillment of the blessings. Right? I'm a humble person. And also, I stayed in my area. I'm not competing with you. I'm a person of the Torah. So, you don't have to worry about me. But all that is not enough. All that is not enough. What else is there? That's very, very important. I think it's a very important lesson to bear in mind. What is it that the guy wants? The love and the approval of the Jew. He needs his approval. He's saying, I want nothing more. I'm Shalom, I'm at peace with you. I want nothing more than to have a personal relationship with you. That's a very powerful message. And we'll explore that some more next week. But that's a very important point to tell him. You see, Limto Chen Dienecha, he could have stopped right there. He could have stopped by simply saying, look, nothing's changed. I haven't gotten the brachos. I'm still keeping the Torah. I still regard you as the older brother. You have no reason to hate me. That's part one. But he doesn't stop with that. Not only do you have no reason to hate me, but me, my whole essence, my whole being, I'm lacking in one thing. I want the excellent. I want to have a positive relationship. That's a very important thing. All right, we'll see you next week.
Part two of the shiur of the meeting of Yaakov and Esav, January 1st, 1992.
Story of the confrontation between Esav and Yaakov. We started doing it last week. This is when Yaakov is returning from his sojourn in Flavon. And he's afraid he's going to encounter Esav on the way back. And when he left, it was because Esav was angry, I mean seriously angry with him, and wanted to kill him because he had perceived the situation that Yaakov had stolen the blessings from him. Right? Okay, so last week we read about the messengers. Yaakov sent messengers for him with a special message for Esav. To try and appease him. And we analyzed the nature of the message. Basically, the essence of the message was that he had spent a long, many, many years with Laban. He'd worked very hard. And to try and indicate to him that the possessions that he had accumulated were not the same things that he had been blessed with. So in other words, that the idea was the blessing had not been fulfilled within me. That was one aspect. To remove the factor of envy. And also, to reassure him, we went into this at length last week. We're not going to review it again today. That he implied that he had retained his commitment to keeping the Torah. In Love on Gaiti, the Tayyaz Mitzvah Shemaki. Right? That he still kept the Torah. And we explained that why it's very